The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
Isoasthenic, so urine osmolality of about 300, essentially equivalent to plasma, is 1010, 1.010. If it's more dilute than that, you've got a patient who's actively trying to dilute their urine.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call continues our discussion with Dr. Joel Toff, who's a clinical nephrologist and winner of the 2017 Robert G. Nairns Award from the American Society of Nephrology. We discuss hyponatremia in the inpatient setting in this episode, and I believe that listening to this will help you think more clearly about hyponatremia. It's a very enjoyable discussion. Joel, thanks a lot for continuing this discussion. And in this episode, let's talk about inpatient hyponatremia, because this comes up all the time. And it is very difficult for the house staff. It's difficult for many attendings. And I think having your wisdom about how to deal with this is going to be really quite worthwhile. So, inpatient comes in, they have a sodium where it's not horribly dangerous, 125 to 135, let's say. How aggressively do you go about diagnosing it? What's your approach? If you got called in right at the very beginning before somebody already gave them too much saline, and talk about why I just said that.
For reasons that are not clear to me, it people love to throw saline at hyponatremia, and you know what? It will solve a lot of the community acquired hyponatremia that we see. A lot of it is going to be volume depletion, which will respond to normal saline a lot, and then another chunk of it will be solute deficiency, which will also respond to normal saline, and then. But you just need to be careful, right? Because a lot of hyponatremia, especially in that range that we see in the hospital, is going to be heart failure and cirrhosis. And heart failure definitely does not respond well to a bunch of saline. And cirrhosis, all of that's just going to go into the belly. And you're just fueling tomorrow's paracentesis with that normal saline. So, yeah. But, you know, my approach, you know, I like to look at the get a global sense of the patient, take a look at the med list. You know, we talked about the medications that are problematic. So you're looking for the antidepressants, antipsychotics. You're looking for your thiazide type diuretics. NSAIDs are another one. You know, it's not usually the chronic NSAIDs, but the patient will have, you know, some degree of what I like to call an unnatural relationship with water. And then they add an NSAID on that, and that can tip them over very often. We've worked out the mechanics there. There are prostaglandins that are involved with handling of vasopressin in the medullary collecting duct. So those are all red flags that I'm looking for. Then you're going to want to take a look at their past medical history. Do they have a known malignancy? You know, and then I love to take a look at the urine itself, right? One of the first things I want to do is I want to know how concentrated is that urine. Order a urine osmolality, but you can just take a look at the specific gravity on the UA. Right. And that because what you just want to see is the urine concentrated or is urine dilute? Super helpful.
Can you explain that this comes up all the time, that medical students, interns and residents don't know how to interpret urine specific gravity?
Yeah. Yeah. So the urine specific gravity is just trying to get it's the density of the urine. And so if the specific gravity is one, it's the same density as water. And you don't ever see that. The lowest you'll see is just about 1.005 is about the lowest. And then normal kidneys can get up to about 1025, 1.025 as the most concentrated urine. And it's going to be thrown off, of course, if you have the urine's contaminated by a lot of glucosuria, that'll raise up the density. If you've got a lot of proteinuria or contrast in that, you know, if you take a UA after a patient's gotten an IV contrast, they'll have a specific gravity of 1040 or 1050, you know, truly, you know, unnatural specific gravities. But the denser really is just an analog for how concentrated that urine is. And isoasthenic, so urine osmolality of about 300, essentially equivalent to plasma, is 1010, 1.010. And so if it's more dilute than that, you've got a patient who's actively trying to dilute their urine. And if it's more concentrated than that, you got a patient who's trying to concentrate that urine. And that's usually what you're going to see in hyponatremia. In most of these cases, you're going to have patients concentrating their urine. That's why they have a small urine volume. That's what predisposes them to the hyponatremia. But those ones when it's dilute is super important, because those are the ones that are going to correct fast. You got somebody who's making dilute urine, that sodium is on its way up. And if you start adding 3% or normal saline, it's going to go up even faster. So it's a real important thing to get to identify quickly to stop yourself from running into trouble.
Okay, so now we've done all the routine things and nothing is obvious. But they still come in with a sodium of 128, 129.
Yeah. So, okay. So, you know, let's just kind of walk through. So if they have the dilute urine, you do the specific gravity, it's 1005, or you got the urine specific, you got the urine osmolality and it's 100. You're looking at either somebody who's on a low salt diet, so we call that by the characteristics of the patients, either a tea and toast diet or a beer drinker's potomania, and that's a situation where their urine output is limited by a lack of solute. They don't have enough solute to excrete, and so that limits the amount of urine volume that they have. And it responds beautifully to adding solute to their diet. So, you know, what we always say is, oh, you need to eat more protein. But the easiest way to get solute into patients is to give them saline. That's there's 308 mil equivalents of solute in every liter of saline. And if their urine osmolality is only 50, 1 liter in is going to be 6 liters of urine to get rid of that at a urine osmolality of 50. And so they will rapidly correct. And so And the other one that will have the low urine osmolality be the patient, the psychogenic polydipsia, the patient drinking tons of water, primary polydipsia. Again, they will correct very quickly, sometimes too quickly. There are definitely case reports of osmotic demyelinating syndrome from patients that were given fluid restrictions after being psychogenic polydipsia, so you need to be careful with them. But again, not a diagnostic dilemma if you see that. Those patients tend to be easy.
I'm making rounds one day, and a patient comes in with the sodium of 125, he'd done it multiple times and he had dilute urine and he really did like drinking beer. He drank a lot of beer and I always ask them the question, and how much do you eat? And they don't eat very much. Yep. And so they don't have any solute. So we just give them food. The whole treatment was we gave them food. Come in about 2 days later and his sodium is in the low 130s from 125. He said, Doc, thanks so much. You lifted the fog off my brain, which I thought was really interesting from our previous discussion about the confusion you get.
Yep.
And this guy was chronically confused because he chronically drank too much beer and ended up in the 125 range. But as soon as we just had him eat, he was good.
Nice. That's a great story. Yeah.
So now we have the concentrated urine.
Yeah, that's the more typical one. That's the one that you're usually going to find. And here you want to – so the first thing you want to make sure you're not dealing with here also is kidney failure, right? Because anybody who's significantly oliguric is going to be able to drink more water than they excrete, and they're going to get hyponatremia. So – and I just want to avoid the unnecessary – the self-error of the patient's got – is a dialysis patient and makes no urine. If they get hyponatremia, it's just – been drinking too much water. They have very little ability to get rid of that water. So you don't need to do a long workup. The answer is very obvious. No urine output, water in, they're going to get hyponatremic. So set those aside. Those patients aren't too difficult to identify. And then you want to take a look at the obvious ones, the patients with heart failure, the patients with cirrhosis. And again, I say obvious, but they're not always obvious. But you want to separate those out. And then there's the obvious ones that have clear hypovolemia. And those are, that's another group that's easy to separate out. And those, again, you know, those, all what we've described, hypovolemia, cirrhosis, and heart failure, those are all appropriate releases of ADH. That ADH is designed to help improve perfusion. Whether it does or doesn't is a different story, but that's the idea for that, for the, that ADH release. And we call that appropriate ADH. And some of those cases are easy to diagnose, but some of them are more subtle, right? You can get, you know, sometimes, you know, everybody says, look at the algorithm for hyponatremia, says, oh, we just need to determine their volume status. And it's hard. A lot of these patients are subtle, and a lot of them, it's difficult to determine what their volume status is. And you just, you do your best to guess that, and you can, and then you can use the lab to assist you. And so one of the things we ask to do, we can take a look at the serum uric acid. I like this one. Serum uric acid tends to be suppressed in patients with SIADH, okay, and increased in patients with volume depletion. So you get a nice separation between those two groups. Right, so it'll be increased with heart failure, it'll be increased with volume deficiency, it'll be decreased with your malignancy associated SIADH, it'll be decreased with your drug induced SIADH. So those are, that's a nice one that can do. Again, it's not perfect, none of these mechanisms are perfect, but it's pretty good. Uric acid, serum uric acid, something simple. You can do a fractional excretion of uric acid, and that'll be increased in SIADH. And the number there you're looking for is about 12%. Higher than 12%, you're looking at an SIADH. Lower than 12%, more like a volume deficiency or fluid overload. And then the urine sodium. Again, it'll tend to be higher in patients with SIADH, looking for numbers like 40, 50, even 90. And it tends to be lower in patients with volume deficiency. But, I mean, so many of our patients, you know, and that, it's not only volume deficiency, but also the effective with the appropriate release of ADH, so including cirrhosis there, including heart failure there. But those heart failure patients, those cirrhotic patients, they're all on diuretics, right? And that diuretics is going to raise the urine sodium. It just makes that what should be a clean answer messier. Right, it's just not as, it's not as good as you'd like, and it doesn't get you out of that room with a clean diagnosis.
How often do you go to POCUS? I'm in a situation where I'm working with residents, and most of them are really good at POCUS, and they can look at the inferior vena cava. And I often say, when someone comes in like that, have you done POCUS to see whether or not they have collapse of their inferior vena cava? Because I learned over the years clinically, I'm not that good at clinically assessing who's volume contracted.
So I am not so good at POCUS, and I can't give you from personal experience, but I want to hear what, since you've got a bunch of wizards of POCUS there, what's been your experience? How good is it?
So a lot of times it surprises the heck out of the residents when they finally go do it. They've been there for 2 or 3 days, and we've been trying to decide, is it volume contraction? Is it SIDH? Or as I call appropriate ADH, like you just said. And so part of my workup now is to have the residents do that, because it's most of the time they can do it. And a lot of times I find that helpful. Mm-hmm. Then I'll say, now we're going to do a test. We're going to increase their volume and see if things get better with that information.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and I mean, and that this is what you end up doing, is you like the ultimate test is to give them the saline and see if the saline helps the condition, right? And then if it is volume depletion, it'll get better. And you just need to be careful. You don't want to do that test if they have heart failure. You want to be, or at least careful about it.
Is there much of a difference in how high the urine osms are in the classic SIDH as opposed to just volume contraction? Or they could all be the same height.
Yeah, that's not an effective way to differentiate these diagnoses.
Okay, so now we've done that. What do you think is the most common reason you're seeing in that 125 to 135 range in the hospital? What are the most, have you already told us what the most common things are?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything new. I think that in that range, it's usually a lot of heart failure. It's a lot of heart failure, and it's a lot of thiazides is what I'm seeing there. In the more severe hyponatremias, when you get down into the 110s and the 105s, that's a lot of SIADH and alcohol Tinnitus syndrome is what I see.
Okay, so I have here is a question. Do we need the diagnosis before we do the treatment? We sort of already said that, but what's the difference in these? Let's say we have three groups. We've got volume contraction, we got the water, the low specific gravity, and then we have the SIDH. Right, so you don't treat those the same, right?
No, but a lot of times the treatment is less dependent on the diagnosis and more dependent on the patient, right? Because sometimes these patients come in and they're seizing, right? Or they have pure encephalopathy, hyponatremic encephalopathy, and we don't pause and we don't delay treatment while we make a diagnosis. Those patients are acutely ill and they need immediate therapy. And you don't mess around with normal saline. You want to give them 3%, and you don't want to give them a drip. You want to give them a bolus. Right, you're looking at the standard dose is 2 cc's per kilo. That always feels a little rich to me. I usually go a little bit lighter than that. I get nervous about it. But that's if you have acute encephalopathy from hyponatremia, that's what you want to do.
How long do you wait before you say, I need to give even more? So I went to a talk many years ago where they said, give 100 cc's of 3% normal saline. Wait an hour. If they're not better, give them another 100 cc's.
Yeah, I like to see the effect and how much the sodium has changed. My sense, the general consensus is if you bump the sodium by 6 or 7 points and they're still having symptoms, start to think maybe it's not the hyponatremia that's causing the symptoms. That generally will prevent the acute problem. That's enough to relieve the increased intracranial pressure, the cerebral edema that we see. You only have to move the needle about 5 or 6 points to relieve that. And so, but, you know, like I said, what I just described to you of like, you know, I give you only about 100 cc's of 3%. That will probably undertreat them, and I may not have moved the sodium fast enough there. And you'll want to go give a repeat dose.
Okay. So we talked about the 125 to 135s where treatment, we're not worried about treating it too fast.
No.
And they usually don't have severe symptoms.
Right.
But now let's talk about the real pain in the neck for all of us, and that's they come in with the sodium significantly below that, below 125, and sometimes in the 10s, and sometimes even lower than that.
Yeah.
And what are the symptoms they have, and what are the usual causes that you see?
Yeah, so I addressed that a little bit earlier, that it's a lot of SIADH in that situation. It's a lot of psychogenic polydipsy or low-solute hyponatremia, so the tea and toast or the alcohol or the beer drinker's potomania. That's mainly what I'm seeing down there. You don't typically see heart failure. You don't typically see cirrhosis with sodiums that low. I'm not saying that's impossible. Those patients tend to not get that low. They tend to stay in the 120s. And if you take a look at the type of urine that they make, they're actually getting rid of free water. They're not getting rid of enough. That's why they get hyponatremia. But the urine they make is effective. And that's different in the situation with SIADH, where they actually are making maladaptive urine, that they're getting rid of more electrolytes than water every time they urinate. It's like every time they urinate, they're drinking more water. It's really, those patients are really difficult to manage, conservatively at least. So those are the diagnoses that I'm looking at. The symptoms that you see, it's a lot of encephalopathy. So the patients will be confused. They may be in a coma. They may be having a seizure. They'll have headaches. They'll have nausea, vomiting. And they, in severe cases, they can have respiratory arrest.
And so those are the people who, if they have those symptoms, they immediately are at 3% normal saline.
That is the acute therapy. If you have altered mental status, that, like we described, like serious altered mental status, not just a little brain fog, you need to give them 3%.
So the first step is just getting that figured out.
Yeah.
You try to send off some urine for analysis. Before you do that, if you can get any.
You try.
But you can't always do it. Seems to me like I order urine studies and the next day nobody collected the urine. I don't know why that happens. I hope that doesn't happen to you.
Never happens to me. They see me coming and they're drawing the urine.
Yeah. Okay. So you get them out of the acute crisis. Again, this is mostly severe SIDH. Occasionally, you can see this with beer potomania.
Yeah. And that surprised me when I first started seeing them that low.
I had a very sad case of a woman who had known primary polydipsia, who went to a mental health clinic and was prescribed an SSRI.
Oh, no.
And so she comes in. We know that she has primary polydipsia. And she comes in with seizures and stuff like that. But her urinosms are like 400 or 500.
Right. Not what you would expect for primary pyelodipsia.
Right. Absolutely. Right.
Right. But her behavior probably didn't change at all. She was still drinking a ton.
Right.
But now she couldn't dilute her urine.
Yeah. And we got a story from her sisters that she'd been with. And that was sort of like, you got to be real careful what you put them on. Have you had patients with primary polydipsia and had psychiatrists try to treat them?
I have not seen that, but I will say that oftentimes what we have is a patient who's got chronic SIADH, and the reason they get sick and they get admitted and they come to our awareness is that they have a lot of a water intoxication on that. Yeah. These patients just don't have a natural relationship with water, and they were drinking a ton, and then they develop severe hypertension. In fact, I have one case of a patient who has congenital central DI. And so he's on a fixed dose of DDAVP to treat his central DI. And then he went drinking with his buddies. And all of a sudden, good. His water intake jumped way up, sodium dropped down, and he had a seizure from acute hyponatremia.
Right.
And, you know, again, that's two different mechanisms there.
So we always call it beer potomania.
Yeah.
But I've seen it with other alcohol if they're not eating. It's not just beer. Is that correct?
It's the lack of solute that's important.
Right.
Right. And the thing about alcohol is that there's no sodium in it. There's no electrolytes in it. And there's all carbohydrates. So it all gets converted to CO2 and water. So there's nothing for the kidney to excrete, no solute for the kidney to excrete in any type of alcohol. I suppose if they had a Bloody Mary with a lot of salt in it.
Yeah. I always tell the joke to my house staff. He said, when you're in college, you knew fraternity boys who drank beer all the time. They never get beer potomania because they never pass up the nachos.
it's an essential safety tip.
Or pretzels. Pretzels are good. Okay, so when you have those very low ones, you treat them, and then you go through the same diagnostic process.
Well, and that the other thing I would want to say is that once you've moved their sodium by 6, then you need to start worrying about going too fast.
Right.
And when they're that low, these patients have an incredibly high rate. Like there was a study that came out of Toronto, looked at patients with sodiums less than 110. 70% of them had their sodiums bumped by more than 8 in 24 hours. And that's not what we should be doing. Those patients are at very high risk for osmotic demyelinating syndrome. And so you need to, even though the first thing you want to do is get their sodium up, then you're like, okay, now we need to put the brakes on. And, you know, I'm a big fan of the DDAVP clamp in these types of situations. And so once you've kind of done both of those things, fix their acute encephalopathy, put the brakes on so the sodium doesn't go up any further, now we can sit back and let's figure out the diagnosis.
Okay, so now I have to argue with you because I have the podcast who just came out recently that you can go up as much as 12, and we don't have to stop at 6 or 8 without causing demyelination. And that's not the only study. There are multiple studies now that suggest that 6 to 8 might be too slow. Have you changed how you're thinking about it yet, or are you still not yet convinced?
I am really engaged with the data. I am not convinced, but I am. I'm on the verge. Like I'm ready to change my behavior. I mean, because I think what we're seeing, and I just for the people who may have not listened to this last podcast that Dr. Center is talking about, is there's been a flood of data in the last 2 or 3 years that's looked at mortality in patients with hyponatremia. And we kind of talked about this briefly, is that these patients are incredibly sick. Once they've lost control of salt and water and homeostasis, this is a bad situation and mortality goes way up. And what we're seeing in some of these cases, case series, hyponatremia mortality mortality with hyponatremia is 20 or 30% hospital mortality or 90-day mortality, like very significant short-term mortality. And then you look, well, what's the rate of osmotic demyelinating syndrome? It's like 0.2% in some of the more contemporary case series. And you start to weigh the two against, like, how much am I going to worry about this 0.2% when I'm facing a 30% hospital or 30-day mortality? That's a reasonable question. And I think the nephrology and critical care literature has done medicine a disservice by only focusing on osmotic demyelinating syndrome and not appreciating the importance of total mortality.
Well, great. And the only other question I have for you is I was just thinking back to a couple patients I had last year who came in with an obvious infection, severe infections, and sodiums in the low 130 range, both of whom turned out to actually have Legionella. How often do you see that? And is there any specific reason that Legionella we always associate with hyponatremia?
So I look for it all the time. Mm. I have not seen it that often, but it's an interesting one, and it's a complex physiology. It's not when I first heard of it, like, oh, it's just going to be SIADH from the pulmonary disease. It's a combination we see all the time, but it doesn't look like that. It's a more nuanced disease. So I don't see a ton of Legionella, and when I have looked for it, I haven't seen much hyponatremia. But it's a well understood phenomena, but it's a complex physiology.
I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one.
Cannot thank you enough for going over. Both in the previous episode and in this episode, ways for us to think about hyponatremia at the bedside and in the clinic. And it's been a great pleasure.
Dr. Santor, this has been an honor. Every time getting to talk with you, I just love it. Thank you very much.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. The first thought I had in re-listening to this discussion was that it's very important for us to be careful in considering a diagnosis before we treat with normal saline. Oftentimes it's the right treatment, but in someone who has beer potomania, tea and toast diet, primary polydipsia on the decreased solute side, or they have severe SIDH, we can harm the patient with normal saline. So we need to think about those. We need to always remember about CHF and cirrhosis as causes of hyponatremia, which portends bad outcomes. And also, many of our hyponatremia patients have decreased volume. Those two situations are called appropriate ADH, and we should not label them as SIDH. The final thought that I had from this conversation is that we had a good discussion about how fast to replete sodium in people with very low sodium. I urge you to listen to our previous podcast, Hyponatremia Correction, How Fast is Too Fast. I think that it will work beautifully along with this podcast and the conversation that we have at the end of this about treating and how fast we can treat. Thank you very much for listening to our podcasts.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall